I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from under an umbrella here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And with us again, Carrie Whitmer. Thank you for coming back, Carrie, to talk about this film.
Thank you for having me.
Well,
When I reached out to Carrie, I sent her the list of movies and this was on there. And Carrie, you said this is one of your favorite books, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I have not read the book. I don't know if Kenny, you've read the book.
No, of course not.
I didn't want to make any assumptions. So I guess, first of all, why do you love the book? Second of all, how do you feel about the adaptation of it?
Oh, I'm really bummed you guys haven't read it. It's so good. I love the book because
it's Graham Greene, correct?
It's Graham Greene. Yeah. So first of all, Graham Greene is probably my favorite fiction writer. I would say I think that he's kind of like the British F. Scott Fitzgerald, I would say.
Okay.
So it's very similar style and very similar themes and characters like that. And I think it's my favorite novel because a lot of things that I was reminded when I was watching the movie, I think the religious themes, like the conflict with God, is really interesting because at the time I read it, I was younger, I was in college, and I was like, it was the first time I was away from home, so I was just like realizing that like religion was just not something that mattered to me. So it really struck
for our listeners, just to give a little bit of backstory, Carrie was raised in a somewhat religious or very religious household.
Very Catholic, yeah.
So that I imagine colors your perspective of this film.
Absolutely. And I think I also just like, even though I didn't realize it the first time I read it when I was younger, I think I really like that the end of the affair kind of explores more vulnerability in male characters. And I also think it's a very well-written female character.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting... So I saw this film in 99. I saw it in the theater. I remember quite liking it. I remember that it was, you know, an Oscar baity movie, came out in early December, and was and continue to be a big fan of Julianne Moore. And we will do our top five Julianne Moore movies at the end of the podcast. But I remember quite liking it. And then I remember it was pretty much disregarded. It was a movie that was kind of, for reasons that I'm sure we'll get into, it didn't really hit. And I think there's a couple reasons as to why. But watching it this time, I was really hit with just how kind of anti-religion it is. I mean, literally the end of this movie is the main character basically telling God to go fuck himself. Yeah. Like, it's kind of crazy.
Kinda. Like, I don't know how anti-religious it is. I mean, the main character is a piece of shit, and there's a miracle at the end of the movie.
But I think it's more about him feeling punished by God, I guess, on some level. And any religious component that I feel Ben Bendricks has, he never really feels like a particularly religious person to begin with. He seems to have a resentment towards it. He's not.
But my point is that it's not necessarily an a-religious or anti-religious text.
That's true.
We talk about the end at the end, or we talk about it whenever we want. But the fact that, like, there appears to have been an actual miracle that happened in this movie.
This is true, too.
Kind of colors my view of where...
Technically two miracles, possibly, depending on how you look at it.
You mean him surviving the bombing would be the second?
Yeah.
So that's the thing that could happen. A thing that can't happen is a woman kissing someone's birthmark and birthmark going away. So
less likely. Yeah.
Yes, less likely. So there are a couple of, you know, one and a half miracles in this movie, and that kind of, I think that has to be taken into consideration.
100%. I didn't mean to make it seem so binary. You're absolutely right. I think that the film is not necessarily, I guess I was surprised by the anti-religious component. Whether or not the film is, and I would agree with you, Kenny, it's more balanced than I'm making it out to be. I was surprised that perspective existed within the film to the extent that it does. That was sort of what I found surprising about it, and not in a bad way. I mean, I guess my point more than anything is, I think there's a lot going on in this film. I think it's a better film than Roger Ebert thought, and most critics. It kind of doesn't exist. It's not even really a movie with two big movie stars for all intents and purposes in a big sort of, and a big director, a lot of, you know, prestige kind of pedigree to it, and it kind of doesn't exist. It's just interesting.
Yeah, it definitely feels like it doesn't exist. It feels like it came out in the wrong year. I mean, more than anything.
Probably, yeah.
It felt like very, and I had seen the movie before about a very long time ago, probably like 10 years ago, and I didn't really remember the movie, which isn't surprising because it's kind of like, I don't know. It feels like almost, I guess I would compare it to, I feel like what happens a lot of times now in like the peak TV era, I'll watch a show on Netflix in a weekend, and then a year later, someone asks me if I've seen it, and I said, no, I don't think so, even though I definitely watched it.
Yeah,
I just, it's just so insignificant is a mean word. But
well, ephemeral, I guess.
Yes, yeah. That's a better, bigger word that I wouldn't have come up with in my brain. It's just like, I guess this exists. And it's
It's interesting because, like, I had the same feeling watching it this time as I did when I was watching it in 99, which is sitting in the theater, liking the movie. Then the movie's done and the movie kind of evaporates.
Yes.
I guess you got to hold it against the film that it doesn't have a lasting power and stay with you. But it also is a positive that when I'm sitting and watching it, I'm enjoying it. So it's kind of odd. It's kind of in its own way, Kenny, unlike anything, or at least from a viewing perspective that I've had thus far, it feels like. Like, we've watched many films, Kenny, that I'm sure we don't remember that are just gone.
But I
would also say that those films also I didn't particularly enjoy when I was watching them.
Oh, yeah, sure. I think I enjoyed this maybe a little less than you, but I wouldn't say I didn't like it.
Yeah.
I
definitely, like, I I don't know. We've done movies that have kind of gone in one ear and the other ear, out the other ear a lot quicker than this one. I think that the it's Neil Jordan. It's our second Neil Jordan film. Other film he did, I have literally no memory of. It was In Dreams, right?
It was In Dreams, and that movie. I'm surprised you don't remember that movie, because that movie's
Robert
got some
Downey
arresting
Jr. was
weird
in it.
Robert Downey Jr. is in it as a crazy person. Lots of apples. There's lots of orchards.
Oh, I think I've seen that one.
Annette Bening.
So I have absolutely yes. Julianne Moore's wife.
Indeed.
Truly, don't remember that film at all.
Really,
I just remember thinking it was not good.
Fair enough.
Think this film is almost really good. Am I crazy?
I think it's almost really good.
Like, it's really well done. It's really powerful. I mean, you know, it has one of I couldn't help but look up in the middle of watching it to see if the score was nominated. It wasn't. It should have been.
It's great score.
It's an incredible score.
It's a powerful score. It carries throughout the entire film. I think it's pretty clear what's going on. I mean, look, I have a bit of a allergy to, I have a bit of an allergy to adultery movies. Not always. But it does feel to me, adultery movies, adultery stories, it feels to me that when someone wants to make a movie about married adults in their 40s and 50s, very often the only conflict anyone could think of is adultery. And it's a little boring to me. It always kind of ends the same way. So the content of this film did not wow me. But the almost everything else about it did. Like almost, I thought the visuals were great. I thought the setting among the bombings of London and the way they juxtaposed that with the affair happening. I thought the chemistry between Julianne Moore and Ralph Fiennes was pretty amazing. I thought Stephen Ray was really good. I really did think it was a really really well done film, and I guess like, if you connected more with the material, I could see something. It was thinking it was just a great film.
Yeah, it's interesting. I agree with everything you're saying. I found myself taken with it in ways that I find perhaps hard to articulate. It's got this passion, but also this emotional reserved Britishness to it. There's like this kind of detachment that's there that feels realistic. I love all the bombing stuff. Especially
that bombs on this podcast.
Yeah, who doesn't love bombs? But also just like there's things in it that shouldn't work and kind of don't work at times, but then do work. Like I think about the sex scene with the bombing and just thinking like this is deeply melodramatic and this should not work, and yet somehow it's kind of working. Like it's doing a bunch of stuff that surprised me. I think it needs to be said that I think one of the reasons this film didn't connect as well as The English Patient. I love The English Patient, but I do feel like, and apparently Kristin Scott Thomas was almost cast in this, which would have been insane. Like, I don't know what, like, just because, no, like, why would you want to bring on all that baggage? No. But also just like, there is, you know, it's based on a lauded piece of literature. It has sort of this adultery love triangle component to it. It's got war times. Like, it's got all the kind of things that sort of exist. They're very different films, but tonally, but I couldn't help but feel like perhaps there was an unfair comparison that was going on to this film.
Yeah, you guys, based on all of the things you like about the movie, you would both really, really like the book.
Should we read the book someday, Kenny?
I mean, it's pretty short. Like, it's a pretty easy book to read. The movie made me really, really want to reread it because it's been a while since I read it. So there's things that I don't exactly remember. I couldn't remember like the kid with the birthmark. I'm like, is that in the book? Because I truly do not remember.
I think it would have to be, right? I mean,
I don't know.
To Kenny's point, it feels like that miracle is so
but
important.
Then exactly. But then the thing is, if it was in the book, I feel like I would remember how weird that is.
Kenny just walked away for a quick second. But yeah, no, I hear you. I think that I have not read the book, so obviously I don't know what's in the book. But that being said, I do feel like it's such a perfect period at the end of this sentence that it'd be surprising if it wasn't.
Yeah, it's. I will say, as a, I think that most, especially modern film adaptations of books, try a little too hard to be like, we're going to have our own like angle on this book. So like the Baz Luhrmann Great Gatsby probably would have been great if they didn't add that whole thing where Nick Carraway is like in a home or whatever. Like that was so weird and so unnecessary.
Yeah, it was like a weird organizing principle they wanted, like this kind of fractured narrative.
But when it's like, that's a perfect book to adapt into a screenplay. You barely have to do anything. I think The End of the Affair is a pretty complicated book to adapt because a lot of the book is Bentrix reading Sarah's diary. So you're reading like a lot of letters and a lot of entries, and they do a quite excellent job at depicting that because it's, I think that's the most complicated thing to adapt, is like a character reading from something that they found in the book. Like it's boring exposition. On the page, it's not, but
no, totally. It is interesting the way that the film's adapted. Again, have not read the book. I'm assuming that the book is chronologically a relatively straight line, or is it told flashbacks?
No, similar. It's very similar. It's very nonlinear.
Which is one of the great things about the movie. I think, too.
And one of my favorite things about the book, I think it was one of the earlier books, I think, that was experimenting with that. I'm not the best literature expert, but it definitely from that era, I think that was pretty non-traditional to tell stories in that way. But I will say, I think you guys were like pretty moved by it and thought it was very emotional. For me, I wanted more of that. Probably because I have more context, I felt like the scope felt very small. Even though it is a pretty small scale story, I didn't get the best sense of the time period or their relationship developing. The actors are amazing. They're really good. And I think they do a pretty decent job at establishing them, but I felt like there could have been more.
I know what you're saying. Yeah. I definitely felt that they fell in love very quickly.
So I hate to be like, here's it happened in the book. But one thing that I think could have improved the movie, in the book, they're, relationship starts off quite antagonistic. Like Bentrix almost like makes, so Bentrix is like making fun of Sarah for who her husband is and how boring he is. And so it lasts for a little bit. And he basically just, it's almost like that rom-com trope where they hate each other and the guy's like so awful to her, but then they fall in love. Whatever,
which I kind of needed a little bit of, because it did feel like they fall in love very quick. Like it's a very passionate thing very quickly. So I do think that it would have benefited from, and I do think that, Kenny, we were talking a little bit about the fractured narrative, right, and the way that the movie is told, which I think is fascinating. And I think that they think that that opening portion is teeing up some of that passion so that when they meet, you don't need the ramp up, but I still think you do. Like, sure. I don't think it's totally there yet. But once it gets there, I bought it. You know what I mean? A little deeper into it, but the jumping around was kind of fascinating. It made me think of the show, The Affair, and the way that that's about like different perspectives on a love affair. And when the movie shifts perspectives at that seismic moment of the bombing, where you see Sarah's perspective after Bendrix's perspective, I think that's all really cool stuff. Like, I think this movie is a lot bolder than I think people think it is. Like, it's
totally, I agree with you.
You know what I mean?
I totally agree with you. There is like some shared DNA with The Affair, but this was less about unreliable narrators.
Yes.
And more about, different POVs, which is perfectly, perfectly valid and an important way to tell the story. It also kind of answer the question I had the first half, which is why was Julianne Moore a lead actor in this film when she, you know, she appears to just be the dilemma. But I think they answer that question by the end.
Yeah.
Phil, did this feel like Moulin Rouge stole some major aspects of this idea?
Yeah, yeah, that was another one that I thought of for sure.
The writer starting it on the typewriter, typing about how horrible everything it is.
The typewriter, the woman
dying of consumption.
Yeah, and also just and Ewan's character at the end, Christian's character, sort of, you know, with his fist to the sky, cursing God and fate and taking away his love. Yeah, no, absolutely. I did that. That's a very apt connection.
If this movie had some more pop songs, I think I might have loved it.
I was thinking about the other thing that really hit me. You mentioned, Kenny, the opening. The photography in this film is stunning.
Yes,
it is.
All of the close-up photography makes it feel claustrophobic. It makes you feel really pulled into... It made me think, actually, of The Insider as well, which does this, of, like, cameras very close to people's faces, really getting into their conversations, into their headspace. I remember being really taken with the photography back in the day, and now I think, like, this film... I don't know if it was nominated for Best Cinematography. My assumption is that it wasn't, but beautifully, this movie, I guess, is deceptively simple, as I guess really maybe the best way to think about it. And I think that it's a lot more challenging than you would expect it to be. I want to read the synopsis very quickly for our listeners who have not seen it. In the years following World War II, writer Maurice Bendrix, played by Ralph Fiennes, has an unexpected run-in with Henry Miles, played by Stephen Ray, and his wife Sarah, played by Julianne Moore, with whom he once shared a passionate love affair. Henry, who never knew, confides in Maurice that he suspects Sarah of adultery, leading to the hiring of a detective, played by Ian Hart, to follow her. As Sarah never explained why she called off their affair, Maurice follows the investigation closely. His feelings for her reawakened. The end of the affair opened in limited release on December 2nd, 1999, and then was released wide on January 21st, 2000. It would go on to make $10.8 million on a $23 million budget. It got 67% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 74% from audiences. I'm just going to read a brief clip from Roger Ebert's 2.5-star review where he says, the film, on the other hand, is as hangdog as Stephen Ray's face in the first scene. It's the story of characters who desperately require more lightness and folly. One can be grim in the confessional, but yet be permitted a skip in the step on leaving the church. The characters seem too glum. We see release, but miss joy. Sarah and Maurice meet for energetic sex, but their conversation doesn't suggest the kind of idealism required by a great love. For a novelist, Maurice is surprisingly pedestrian in his speech. We have to hear him telling Sarah of his jealousy of her shoes because they take you away from me. Not impossible dialogue. We are reminded of Prince Charles's fantasies involving feminine hygiene products, but we expect...
Not all of us.
But we expect better from a novelist. First of all, the shout out to Prince Charles speaking of wanting to be Camilla's tampons, I think is what he is referring to.
What?
Yeah, that was a thing in their conversations. My apologies for being crass, but that's what he said and that's what he's referring to. So I'm just putting it out there.
I'm so embarrassed for him. 40 years later.
I would be embarrassed for Prince Charles too in this situation.
No, that's so sad.
Embarrassed for Prince Charles for many reasons, but
that's what Ebert's referring to for people that don't know.
How did you know that, Phil? Was that in The Crown?
No, it was in a...
No, it wasn't. I don't know about it.
Do you know the podcast You Don't Know, or you... Fuck, I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, there was a podcast that did a very in-depth, like, 6-part miniseries on Diana that I listened to. You're wrong about that's what it is. It was amazing. Everyone should listen to it. Yeah. And they go into explicit detail as to the conversations between Prince Charles.
I don't think I need to listen to it anymore. I think you just gave away the ending.
But all that being said, Ebert's review seems unnecessarily harsh. I don't think that this film is lacking in poeticism.
Let's figure out what it was about this moment that lent itself to that kind of review, because we see this a lot on the podcast, I think, where some things hit 1999 a lot differently than they hit 2021. And I think some of that is because in the 90s, while there's this indie revolution going on, and while there are these, you know, quirky things like that we love, you know, being John Malkovich and Election, like kind of towing the line between comedy and drama and all these other things that, you know, these big budget Jurassic Park epics, there are also a lot of costume. This is really costume drama, but a lot of period drama with literary bona fides. Mm-hmm. And this feels like, and they would all kind of follow the exact same rollout. They would be dropped in December. They would almost always get a Best Actress nomination, and that's it, or maybe Best Costume nomination. They would always make about $10 to $30 million, and they would almost always be forgotten. And some of them are really kind of, you know, bad, and some of them win Best Picture, like English Patient. But I do feel like there was some fatigue at this point when it comes to a film like this. Watching it in 2021, structurally, I thought it was very bold. And I think that this is maybe a half step or quarter step forward from the stuff that came before it, and that might just not have felt like enough. Now, not The English Patient, obviously. The English Patient is its own animal, and it takes kind of in the throes of war. But I've always been very fascinated by the rest of Europe that didn't choose to be in a war. And that's not, by that I don't mean obviously England chose to be in a war, had to be in a war, or was pulled into a war. But you know, the English citizenry was kind of caught in a war, mm-hmm. or the occupied French were kind of caught in a war. And I find that stuff to be endlessly fascinating. Or, you know, the expats in Italy, like we talked about too with Mussolini. I find that stuff to be endlessly fascinating, the way life really did go on as they were getting bombed or dislocated or kicked out of their homes. And that stuff is really interesting to me. So, yeah.
Well, I do wonder, to piggyback on what you're saying, if part of it is this is a very interior, intimate movie. This movie doesn't have like the sweep of these things usually, right? Like, and by that I mean, not to keep comparing it to The English Patient, but The English Patient has this, you know, this obviously it's about deserts. It's this David Lean-esque kind of scope to it, right? And this movie, even just looking at the photography, is very intimate. It's very closed off. It's very claustrophobic. It's in, you know, literally mostly in interiors, or it's in the rain. Like, it's just, it's got a very, you know, it's a sad story. You know what I mean? And I think that, to your point, Kenny, I wonder whether or not that felt antithetical to what people expect from a period drama as well, to some extent.
Yeah, I think people at that time were probably expecting, especially since it occurs mostly throughout World War II, they were expecting to see those big visuals and expecting like bigger moments than you got when that was just kind of the background. I was going to say, it kind of almost reminds me of Greta Gerwig's Little Women, and like with the nonlinear structure.
Sure.
And it's very mostly interiors, very intimate. And it's the kind of story that could almost like kind of take place at any time. It just has those different elements that are there, but they're not, especially like when I think of the 1994 Little Women, which is also amazing. It's not as modern. It's more about this was the time period, and where they emphasize that. And then Greta Gerwig is just like, they're all in these costumes, but this is a modern story. And I think The End of the Affair is very similar to that. It's like, we're just going to tell this story that could happen at any time, but it's based on the book, so we're going to do it here.
Yeah, I agree with everything both of you are saying. It feels very intimate. I mean, the biggest moment of the film is that explosion. And it's about the emotional ramifications, or I guess, depending on how you interpret it, perhaps the spiritual as well. You know, just all of that feels so different. But to your point, Kenny, maybe it just wasn't overt enough or different enough. Like, it's an intellectual exercise, maybe more so than an emotional one, which I think is probably why it dinged people too.
And I do think, like, generally, I think the reason why I do really like the movie, even though I said it's pretty forgettable, like a Netflix show I watch in 2 days, but I think, like we discussed, it is visually stunning. The score is great. The performances are amazing. Like, I can't believe I honestly forgot about like Jason Isaacs in this. Like, he's so good. And he's like barely in the movie, but like, I just, and when I saw him, I was like, oh my gosh, I remember this performance and I completely forgot he's in this. But now I lost my train of thought, but I think it's just like one of those movies where they just got so caught up like in the story almost that they kind of forgot to take a step back and say like, what's something surprising we can add to this, because it's all very, very good, but there's nothing that is, not that it's not unique, but there's nothing that's particularly shocking about it.
Yeah. And I do wonder too, about the casting a little bit. I think that, I mean, I love Ralph Fiennes, I love Julianne Moore independently of each other. I'm not entirely convinced that they have, it's not that they don't have chemistry, they do. But I also think that Ralph Fiennes in general struggles with chemistry. He's not an actor that, generally speaking, has the most chemistry with his female leads. So, I wonder if that's adding to this too on some level.
Julianne Moore has chemistry with everybody.
Anything.
It's just her thing. I don't know. It's like, I just could. There are people like this. So like, they're like magical people who just make you so happy to be around, and you're so comfortable immediately. That's just who she is. Whether she's she's Amber Waves. You know, 1940s British socialite, I guess. I guess I agree with you, though. I did feel pretty strong sexual chemistry between them, and not just because of the ass.
This really amazing the ass, sex scenes.
The ass grabs were that's
a lot of ass grabs. Yeah,
that's trust with your co-star.
Yeah.
And those sex scenes are really, really well done. You actually see thrusting, which I like. I don't like it when it's like an implied sex scene, I call it, where they're like kissing and then like it goes black when they like clearly start fucking. It's like we see them fuck like multiple times.
We do.
And it's so good.
We do. I agree. It's a sexually explicit movie, but not in a gratuitous way. It does feel as though you understand the passion that exists between these two people, and it feels realistic. And I would also say too, you know, I alluded to this earlier. You know, there's a moment when they're having sex during a bombing, and essentially, it's like he's testing her as to how much she really loves him and whether or not, you know, they can withstand these bombs, essentially, whether or not their love can, I guess, to some degree or another. And it fucking works. To say it out loud, it sounds silly. But somehow you're just like, fuck. Yeah, no, I buy this.
That's from the book, Carrie.
And the character is very similar in the movie. I think they did a very excellent job at portraying his jealousy and how kind of like he's pretty much a piece of shit. Like he's kind of awful. But
which Rafe does play well. Like he has done that in the past and continues to do it.
Which is why I was going to say it to me, it almost doesn't really matter that Ralph Fiennes doesn't really have chemistry with her, because it's more about the passion, which they got right. And even in the book, the relationship is, they are in love, but it's more about Sarah's sexual satisfaction, as it is in the movie too. But I think the book, most books capture those like things about the characters better than the film adaptation can, but they do a good enough job that you guys got the same sense that I do from the book of the characters. So,
yeah, it's really pretty impressive how so Julianne Moore chased this role. Apparently, Neil Jordan considered Miranda Richardson, Kristin Scott Thomas were the two other people that they considered for the role, and she chased it. And I think good for her. I think she's great in this movie. I kind of can't imagine anyone else in this role, quite honestly. She has this, I mean, as we'll discuss in our favorite Julianne Moore movies later, there is something about Julianne Moore that's so unbelievably watchable. She has this aura about her. And even if at times I'm not totally sure I buy her accent 100% at times, and we discussed this a little bit, Kenny, in An Ideal Husband, where she also pops up as a British.
I'm far less precious this way than the other way. Americans going Brit, like, it all sounds fine to me. Brits going American, same. You better get it fucking right, or I will punch you into the Atlantic Ocean.
I'm with you, Kenny.
But when she first shows up and she's got the British accent, my immediate reaction was like, it almost sounded slightly like Maude Lebowski. So that for a brief second, I was like, and then I was fine with it. But yeah, it's she just, I don't know, man. There's something about her that is just so unbelievably captivating.
I want to say one thing.
Yeah.
She is so fucking pretty. Like,
yeah, no, she's gorgeous.
Like, she is so, I don't think people appreciate just how fucking pretty she is. She's so unusual and gorgeous, and there's like no one like her. I mean, it really is like, I find her like somewhat breathtaking in a way that you don't even find most gorgeous people or most gorgeous actors and actresses that it does really inform this role too.
For sure. There's also a chameleon component to it as well, Kenny, in the sense that like her look in this film with these big giant curls that they and the sort of the obviously the costumes and what have you. But then you think about the chameleon-esque way that she's able to sort of, you know, like I just said, she can play Maude Lebowski, she can play Amber Waves, and then she can play this. You know, it's people just, I don't know, they don't respect Julianne Moore as much as they should.
I agree. And Julianne Moore, there isn't really a comp for her. Like, I can't think of another actress from another era who she is like, and I don't think there will ever be another actress that is like her in the future.
I agree. There's a fearlessness to her, and yet there's also this. She's not rubbing your face in it. Like I really just get there's something about when I think about like, is this her only film in 99, Kenny? Is this the only?
No, I did your husband.
Oh, right. Of course. Sorry. I literally said it and then didn't even. That's how much An Ideal Husband stayed with
me. There's another one too, Phil.
Is there?
It might come up on your favorite Julianne Moore.
Oh, is it Map of the World? Is that the other one that she's in, I think? That's also
no. No. I mean, yes, but no.
Oh, I know what. Yeah. I won't say it. I know which one it is.
Phil.
Oh, of course. Of course. Fuck. Of course. Jesus Christ. She's, yeah. No, obviously it's Magnolia. Yeah. No, I can't believe I didn't think of that. But, she had just such an
was she nominated for Map of the World?
Or was she nominated for this? I thought she was
nominated for this. She was nominated for this.
Was Sigourney nominated for Map? She was in four movies this year. Was Sigourney nominated for Map of the World?
I don't think Map of the World was nominated for anything. Oh, Globes, maybe. Globes, anything's possible, but not
anything's
Oscars.
Possible. All right.
Not Oscars.
But Julianne Moore is, we're catching her sort of in this really fascinating period in her career. 98, she does Boogie Nights, and she does The Lost World in 97. And you just have this, just very, like, she's really kind of taken a lot of swings. She's in Hannibal in 2000. She's becoming a movie star, but then is never really a movie star. And I don't say that in a denigrating way. I just don't know that she ever was like, that she ever crossed that threshold to being a household name in the way that someone like a Kate Winslet or a Kate Blanchett, you know what I mean?
Maybe not at that level, but it can't be ignored that she won an Oscar for a movie that no one cares about.
Correct.
So when you win an Oscar for the Reader, or when you win an Oscar for
Still Alice,
Still Alice, you have like gotten to the point where people where people feel yeah. like you've been so good for so long that we will just acknowledge that, that you tried really, really hard to win an Oscar here and we're going to give it to you.
I agree with that 100%.
Yeah. I mean, her performance in Still Alice is really phenomenal. It's, I would say it's much better than like Kate Winslet in The Reader, but she did, well, it was,
I didn't see either of them.
Okay. Even if Julianne Moore's performance was not as good in Still Alice, she still deserved to just be handed the Oscar for it.
Oh, 100%. Julianne Moore, I mean, and we will get to this when we talk about our favorite films of hers, but like Julianne Moore losing for Boogie Nights is one of the worst losses, I would argue, of at least of our generation to some degree. Mm-hmm. I really love Kim Basinger in L.A. Confidential. She's very good in that film. And it's a very good movie. Julianne Moore's doing something next level in Boogie Nights.
I remember Julianne Moore in Boogie Nights more than Kim Basinger in L.A. Confidential.
And Kim Basinger is kind of to your point a little bit, Kenny, too, which is the Oscars love a fucking, you know, they love a narrative, right? They love a...
It's all narrative.
It's all narrative.
It's all narrative, and Kim Basinger fit the narrative really fucking well that year. Yeah. Julianne Moore just didn't. And weirdly, in her own movie, because it was her coming out too, right? Mm-hmm. You look at Julianne Moore's filmography, and it was small sporting role, and then... You know, that's the female lead of that movie.
Yeah.
But she was out ingenued in that movie by Heather Graham. So she couldn't really fit the ingenue category, and she couldn't fit the great narrative store thing that, like, you know, the one that I remember that I mean, I think the movie's garbage, but Virginia Madsen in Sideways. Virginia Madsen in Sideways had, you know, people thought she was really, really good, but there was just no great narrative there. And Kim Basinger's narrative was fantastic. It's like this pretty face doing work. It was not even like she doing great work. It was like, look at her.
Who won the Oscar and Best Actress for the 99 years?
It's Hilary Swank for Boys Don't Cry. Yeah.
Unimpeachable.
Also, the narrative. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one was going to beat that.
No, too much.
Well, but the narrative in that year was the Annette Bening in American Beauty versus Hilary Swank in Boys Don't Cry. And you know, again, Annette Bening still Oscarless, which is insane. But again, that's sort of one of those things where, I mean, Hilary Swank deserved it. I'm not in any way suggesting that she didn't. But that's one of those things where the performance is so unimpeachable that it trumps the narrative. Yeah, Hilary Swank.
I totally agree.
That it beats the narrative.
All that year was in that. I mean, look, that's the only good part of that movie, Annette Bening.
Kenny's thoughts on American Beauty are less than flattering.
No, she's amazing. She's unbelievable.
I think I probably agree, although it's not a movie I ever want to see again for a big reason.
Reasonable.
Yeah.
Reasonable.
It's worth watching for anthropological reasons.
Yes.
For real. You know what? It's
crazy.
It makes sense. Like at the time, I'm not talking about American Beauty, but you know, it's this podcast. It's really just about 99 movies.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Woodstock 99 reconsideration thing, how we got here and what happened and what was going on in the culture. It's really interesting that what was considered to be high art and artistically revolutionary at the time was really just a slightly more stylized way of objectifying women. And that, and because we were so fucking far gone in 99 in terms of the way that we like objectified women and glorified violence and, you know, promoted rape culture and all these things, that a kind of movie called American Beauty about rape seemed to be a-okay.
Well, not just a-okay. I mean, it was as we discussed in the episode, embraced and obviously put to the, you know, one best picture and all that.
Yes, Ebert's fundamental point was we all want to rape. This is just like,
if you read his review, Carrie, for American Beauty, it's literally like, come on, guys, we all want to do it. You're just like Sam
Mendes and Alan Ball just found like a real tasteful way to rape.
Yeah.
And this is, if you're going to rape, this is a good way to rape.
All right. Okay. I'm going to move on from this.
That movie is an issue.
Interesting that End of the Affair is also 99 because those sex scenes are about both sexes, which is very refreshing. And even today, last year I spent many months watching sex scenes for an article that I wrote for The Ringer. So I know about sex
scenes. What article was this?
So I watched like a bunch of sex scenes from different actors, like I think like 30 different actors for several months. And I like calculated how long the sex scenes were, how many sex scenes in each actor's filmography they were, and just like did all this analysis on it. You can, if you just Google like sex scenes, The Ringer.
No, we'll link to that on our Twitter for sure.
What I learned is that's why I was so frustrated. I hate implied sex scenes because it's just like, okay, in some movies they work, but in most it's just like, oh, like you just didn't want to have to choreograph this. It's fine if the actors aren't comfortable doing it, but it's usually not.
Carrie, you're amazing.
Thank you.
I'm looking at this right now. Wow.
I want to unpack this for a second because I do think it's actually integral to this film. It does feel like sex scenes, by and large, can be pulled from movies, right? Like they're there because we like watching attractive people, you know, pretend like they're having sex, whatever.
Yes.
And to your point, more times than not, they're perfunctory and they're just kind of there. And those are the ones that we tend to cut away from.
Yes.
These sex scenes are integral to the story, right? Kenny highlighted how the passion is so palpable between these two people that without it, this movie would be completely DOA.
Yeah.
It's really Carrie's kind of point that about sex scenes in general, which is, all right, so the bar for sex scenes is so low that when you show something that kind of looks like actual sex, it feels like, you know, the passion of a, you know, of a thousand suns, to mix metaphors.
Yeah.
But there is something like that. I didn't think this sex was like particularly sexy.
Yeah.
I just thought this sex looked like someone who was actually trying to have good sex.
Exactly. And hate to say in the book again, but in the book, the first time they have sex is like really, really awkward and uncomfortable. It's like, and they capture that pretty well, but it's not as passionate or as sexy as it is in the movie. But the first time they have sex is like really strange, which is normal. And I think they do a good job making it as realistic as sex is in real life, which most other movies don't.
Here's the big issue. With sex in movies, and Carrie, this is obviously your domain.
Thank you.
But if you have sex with someone for the first time in a movie, and it does not set off literal fireworks, your relationship is doomed to fail.
Yes,
that is not real life. That is not real life. Sexual chemistry is not fucking innate. It is earned. It is worked on. It is built. It is like, it's based on trust. It's based on like communication. And the idea that you're supposed to like magically understand what the other person wants is fucking nuts.
Yeah, all right.
My little rant.
So the other thing I was going to say, like the reason why it's surprising that it's from 99 is that most sex scenes are all about just seeing a female actress.
Female
naked.
Nudity. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like you see a woman's tits and she's like on top of a man and that's it. Like you
whereas their first sex scene, she's fully clothed and we're seeing his butt.
I want to say one more thing.
His white British butt.
I have four children and one of my child's teachers in this house as I'm screaming about sexual pleasure.
Just, oh, yeah, a little bit of a purview so, into the Nybar household.
A little nervous about the way this is going to go when I walk out of this room.
To your point, Carrie, I do feel like this movie, which is directed by a man, seems to be going out of its way to show believable sex that feels believably passionate for both parties.
Yes.
And I think that that's an important distinction.
Yeah.
This movie jumps around in time a lot, but there's a couple lines and a couple moments that I do want to kind of highlight. And just for what it's worth, story-wise, essentially, I gave the synopsis. It's not a particularly complicated story, really. It's just about Julianne Moore is married to Stephen Ray and he thinks she's cheating. She's cheating with Ralph Fiennes. Ralph Fiennes decides to kind of follow along with the investigation into this adultery. And in the process, finds out about why Sarah called off their affair. Now, Kenny, when you stepped away for a second, Carrie was saying that in the book is told primarily through Bendrick's reading Sarah's diary. So Which is what the second part of this movie is about, essentially, which is he gets the diary from the detective, and the diary pieces in her perspective. Thus, essentially, the major sort of central thing that happens is that Bendrix goes out into the hallway at one point post-coital and an explosion goes off. He's blown into the stairwell. It looks like he's dead. We see this from the first time from his perspective, which is him waking up and Julianne Moore is praying in the bedroom, essentially. When we later realize that she was praying for him to survive and she prays to God, if he survives, I'll never see him again. And when he survives, she takes it as a sign from God that she can no longer see Bendrix anymore. He did not know that perspective. He thought that she was just kicking him to the curb for reasons that he didn't understand. And it's sort of this Rashomon-esque perspective shift that allows us to be able to understand why this affair dissolved, essentially. But we do have sort of these moments in the first half of the film where they meet up and he's very cold and shitty to her. And she can't tell him why she broke off the affair. I guess if I have one nitpicky narrative thing, does she think that if she tells him, God will renege on what, I'm a little unclear as to, is that what she thinks? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why she feels like God is being a real cock blocker in this situation.
I also think it's something that she might be embarrassed about.
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah, I can see that.
I think Julianne Moore kind of plays it more the latter. Like it's sure. It's kind of an embarrassing thing to admit to someone that it's like, oh, well, I can't see you because of God.
If someone said that to me, I'd be, you know,
well, you'd be like, yeah, but you'd also be like, oh, all right, great. Like, see you later. Like,
see you, fine.
See you never. Yeah.
I do love, there's a line that Bendrick says to Sarah. She says, is he writing a book? Is he writing a book about them? And he said, a book takes a year to write. It's too hard work for revenge, which is a great line. And I would concur. I think at a certain point you'd run out of, you'd be like, fuck it. It's like, that's not worth it.
It's true.
I love the kiss under the rain under his coat.
Yeah.
I love that moment. This movie does, and again, it's not to belabor the point, but it doesn't hit these things as hard as I think people want it hit. Do you know what I mean? Like the romanticism, like what I love about that moment, essentially, Bendrix remembers a pop flash, essentially, of them kissing in the rain under his coat. And it's a beautiful, tender, loving moment, but it's not made to be gigantic. And I think that that's why this film didn't hit with people. It's moments like that.
Yeah, and a lot of those big moments are very fleeting, and I think that they're meant to be. It's like when Bendrix reveals the affair to Henry, Henry's not like, he doesn't punch him or anything. It's just kind of
right.
Like, okay. And then they're like kind of friends, and then they like basically nurse her. To death together, and they're like roommates. It's kind of funny.
Yes.
So I think people might have, they want, when the adultery is revealed, they want this like big emotional fight.
Catharsis.
Moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't get that at all. You get actually a lot of peace and harmony.
Well, it's very, and I don't want to, this isn't a bad thing, but like, it's very British. Like this movie's very British in the way that it's all very sort of like, it's very formal for, you know what I mean? In terms of, especially the Stephen Ray character. He feels tremendously British to me, even though he's played by an Irish actor, if I'm not mistaken. This movie is directed by I believe that Stephen Ray and Neil Jordan are both Irish.
I think so.
But there's something
Stephen Ray's
very,
his guy.
Yeah, Stephen Ray is very much this guy. I think he did like 9 movies with him or something like that. But that sort of, and to what you just described, Carrie, of like literally Stephen Ray seeks them out and to take Ray finds a sign and be like, so FYI, she's dying and I'm not here to like put a cramp in your affair, but like you've really only got a couple months. Why don't you move in and we can become friends and nurse her through this. It's a very sort of it's very sort of stuck up in a weird, in a perfectly kind of British way.
Yeah, and I say that Graham Greene is British F. Scott Fitzgerald because it is so British, and it's like pretty similar stories to Fitzgerald, but they're so British. Like there's so British. I don't know if you like read about this, but the end of the affair was inspired by Graham Greene's affair that he had an affair, and it's inspired by that. And his home in London, I think, or somewhere in the UK, was hit during the Blitz. So that's, I don't know if he was fucking his lady while that happened.
That's right, Graham.
But
you got yours, Graham.
Yeah. Right?
I want to just highlight for a quick second.
Lady. You know, and Graham Greene's wife was probably a lady.
Probably appropriate.
I
want to go back to the bombing just for a quick second, the explosion, because first of all, it's so fucking well done. The explosion, it's like, it's essentially awesome. This like wind that blows through the apartment essentially before the explosion even goes off. So there's like this almost like a calm before the storm, if you will. The explosion is incredibly well done. We see it from a couple angles, as I mentioned earlier. But the shot of Bendrix waking up in the stairwell, it's so beautifully monochromatic. It's just ash all over him. And then, you know, they have this tremendous scene, which we see a couple times, obviously, of Sarah saying, basically, Bendrix kind of deduces that Sarah's disappointed that he survived this explosion. And he's just like, what the fuck? Like, why are you disappointed? And she says to him, love doesn't end just because we don't see each other, which again is this beautifully sweeping notion, but is done in such a grounded way that, again, this is why I feel like this movie just didn't connect with people on an emotional level. But she says that to him. It's a great fucking scene. The idea of two people professing their love to each other in a bombed out apartment, covered in ash and blood, is just that's fucking great shit. I don't know. Yeah. I love it.
If this movie came out 6 or 7 years earlier, I think it would have been viewed very differently by critics and by the American public, or by the I guess the global public. I it is a really good movie. It's less impactful in the wake of, you know, English Patient, I'd also throw Sense and Sensibility in that.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
I think that it, the Little Woman adaptation from, you know, 94, they like it does sometimes feel like, you know, we've done it already. We're here. And so I feel like this suffers the same kind of fate, right? So
It's also, you know, it's I tweeted the poster for it the other day. And it's a beautiful poster. I think it's a really beautiful poster. But it's also a poster of just like two people under an umbrella with just sheets of rain coming down, like, which is very emblematic of the film. But again, like, it's gloomy, right? Like, it does have this grim gloom. But I kind of dig that about it. I don't know. I think that's one of the things that I feel like makes it stand out. But I can understand why it didn't for people. But
yeah.
So then basically Bendrix... Then he chases Sarah around for a bunch, which kind of felt a little bit like, dude, take a hint, but whatever. He eventually does convince her to go away together. That's when Henry comes and tells them that she's dying, and we have this. we have inviting Bendrix to come and live with them while Sarah is dying. We then get sort of of course. Yes. Will, I did you see the note, I'm assuming, that Kenny just sent?
I can't help myself. It's like, I have a problem. I mean, Will, pull out this whole thing, but I'm not. Well, but
you can just pull out that one line.
It went so well. And like,
oh, that's
so
great.
Now, like, now they might even like listen.
But we're going to cut all of this, obviously, but Carrie, to give you perspective, Kenny pitched an idea to Chris Weitz. And since Chris Weitz directed The Golden Compass, he's decided that he doesn't necessarily want to shit on his film, which is an awful thing.
We also we were not very kind to American Pie, so we asked that to be pulled down temporarily. And
so I don't know what we're going to do about that, but it's pulled, but I guess we can, I don't know.
We're going to re-record the whole thing. We're going to pull Taylor Swift on this one.
Oh, wow. But what's our excuse to our listeners who have heard the previous one?
Oh, we're just going to drop it like it never happened. We're just going to put it back on the slot.
We're going to
sneak it back in number three like it never happened.
You're insane. But I love this. Okay. But that being said, now we're at the point in the film, Kenny, that we talked about earlier, which is when Bendrix essentially is really coming head to head with God and being like, and by God, it's essentially Jason Isaacs who's playing this priest. And it's in sort of, it's in Henry and Sarah's house. Bendrix is completing his book, which is a diary of hate towards God. I mean, the whole thing is just his basically Sarah, while Sarah doesn't need to see God to love him, Bendrix prays God will leave him alone. And that's basically the end of the film. I agree with you, Kenny, that it is not necessarily siding with Bendrix and his perspective I'm going to backtrack very quickly here and just say that the detective has a young son who has been coming around with him, who has this birthmark on his face. At midway through the film, Sarah kisses his face. At the end of the film, the birthmark is gone. And we're sort of led to believe that is Graham Greene's way, or the film's way, certainly, of acknowledging that there might be a higher power. Kenny, do you feel as though that is the overriding sentiment more so than Bendrix?
Much more so than Bendrix. And furthermore, I don't think Bendrix is saying, I think he's explicitly saying there is a God and I hate you.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I don't think the existence of God is in question in this film. I think the question is the nature of God. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
So
yes.
I agree with that too. Yes.
And if God picks favorites, and if God, you know, is out to get certain people, if God can grant miracles, et cetera, et cetera. But
do you also think it's about POV too, which feeds into it as well, right? It's a perspective of God. It's that idea of what that, like, this does feel like a very sort of like you know, two very different POVs. So,
but I will say the stuff with the birthmark really took me out of it. Like it, the idea that Julianne Moore, it didn't need it at all, and that the idea was not that she was in some way angelic or some way connected to God. It's that had nothing to do with anything to me. So, and again, I don't think that I don't think that, and maybe I'm totally wrong, and this might. The book might be explicit in this, but it didn't feel like this was about whether or not the narrator was reliable, whether or not we were seeing a skewed version of events from Bendrix's point of view. It felt like this really happened. Now, like, again, weird thing to say in the conversation, you know, around and about Julianne Moore, when the lesson of Magnolia is shut up. But so basically there is a shut up aspect to this kind of stuff. Yeah. Like, okay, it happened. What does it mean? It definitely took me out of it. And like my rating at the end is reflective of where I was at the end of the film because of this.
Yeah.
But
I don't disagree.
Changed my rating significantly.
Yeah, I've jumped around a fair amount as well. I want to say, I wonder. I guess I don't know if I needed to see the kid's face. Like, I almost feel like if I just heard it, if I just heard the dad say it, I kind of would have been like, okay, that's a little weird, but okay. But showing it and kind of really putting a spotlight on it with this slow turn and this music swelling and, like, to your point, Kenny, it makes it too big a deal when it could have been played a little bit more subtle and still had the same effect.
Or you just see one side of the kid's face that doesn't have the birth.
That's interesting. Yeah. No, I agree.
It's a little dramatic. And I said this earlier, but I truly do not even remember if this is in the book or not.
Right.
I feel like it has to be. But I was trying to remember this specifically if it was in the book, because it's been so long since I've read it. But I know that's like hypocritical because I say it's like one of my favorite books, but I can't even remember if a kid loses a birthmark or not to a kiss. But I read like all these summaries of it, of the book, and I could not find that in any of the summaries.
That's interesting. Maybe it's not in it.
But I need to now order the book and read it and find out and let you guys know.
Please do,
because it's going to drive me crazy.
So, Kenny, I want to hit on your Moulin Rouge thing real quick, because the very last shot of this film is essentially the last shot of Moulin Rouge as well, which is a typewriter. Now, the Moulin Rouge ending is love lasts forever, right? That is love for her will never end, and it's obviously a far, far more romantic notion in a far more romantic film. This film ends with very little discussion of love and more about leave me alone. Like the last words that we see on this are leave me alone. It's a much more, I mean, obviously it's a much more depressing and sadder ending, but it's also, it feels right in some way. Like Bendrix is just, you get the impression at least that he is this very sort of, a woe is me character, but also that there's something very British about him. It's the most British Ralph Fiennes has ever felt to me. The way he walks, the way he carries himself, his clothes are very bland. Yeah. Like there's just something, you know what I'm saying?
His big ass trench coat. Yeah.
Big ass trench coat. Like this guy great trench. So like the end of the film being just like, leave me alone. I don't know, really hit home for me. It worked.
Yeah.
Why don't we rate this? Because I want to talk Julianne Moore. I saw this film in 99, as I mentioned. I quite liked it. I probably would have given it a 75 back in 99. I thought it was good. I quite liked it. And I was surprised that no one seemed to care about it. Before the podcast, I would say I actually went down a little bit. I went down to a 70 because I was sort of like, there was some stuff that you know, I liked it quite a bit, but was also like, maybe I didn't like it as much as I thought I did. Now I'm up to an 80. This conversation has made me like it even more. I think it's a really good movie, and one that people should seek out. I think it's a really interesting film to watch through a 2021 lens. I think it's as Carrie or connoisseur of sex scenes mentioned, I think that the sex scenes are really powerful and really well done. And that's where I'm at. What about you, Kenny?
I gave it a 59 before this thing, which I don't normally mess around with 50s. There's something about 50, it's something about 51 to 59 that feels a little bit like kissing your sister, right? But
I don't agree. As someone who does mess around with the 50s, as you say,
you do. You love the 50s. But I feel like that it's very fence-sittery sitting to me, or whatever it is. It just it all sounds much more judgmental than it needs
okay,
to.
Okay.
I'm not being judgmental with this. It just is. There's something about being in the 50s that always feels. It always just felt like. If you want to know what it really is for me, Phil? It's just not where a lot of movies land for me. That's just ultimately I am a very opinionated person, and I feel very strongly about my opinions usually. And for a movie like this, it's like, yeah, this is good. Like, I enjoyed a lot of good stuff here. And I definitely, it's too good to be like, don't see it. That's the way I felt.
Yes.
It's too innovative and too powerful and just too well done.
Yeah.
But I gotta go higher. It's much better than a 59 after this conversation. I was gonna go up to a 71 before. Phil, your 80 is bold, but also feels kind of right. I'm gonna go a little higher. I'm gonna go up to like a 77. 59 to 77 is quite a bump, it's a good film. It really is a good film.
What about you, Carrie? What did you think in around when you first saw it and then before podcast, after podcast?
Oh gosh, when I first saw it, probably 10 years ago, maybe more, when I was like really, really into this book and it was like, sadly, my personality. I did not like the movie, probably because I was like, oh, this isn't as loyal to the book as it could be. Like a huge, huge nerd shit, so pretentious. I was a different person back then.
That's why I don't like Moneyball. So what are you going to do? We all have our issues.
Okay.
And I've come around
like
to Moneyball
this,
too. Carrie has come around on this.
The first time I saw the movie many years ago, I don't know what my rating would have been, but probably like in the really low, like unfairly low, like 40s. And before the pod, I was thinking I was going to give it like 68.
Okay.
Like late 60s, early 70s, but I think I'm bumping it to 75.
I love it.
Because after this conversation,
we're around the same place.
Good place.
Yeah, I'm realizing how good it actually is and how unique it truly is compared to other movies like it.
Seriously.
And I kind of want to read the book and then I want to watch the movie again.
Well, please let us know if the birthmark is in the book.
If anyone listening, I don't know.
If anyone listening knows, just tell us.
Maybe I'll finish reading the book by then. But it's a pretty quick read. But
we should just, we'll just tweet. See if anyone comes back to us with it.
Kept good. It's so sad. I think of myself as a pretty good Googler. Meaning that I know I'm good at SEO, I guess. I know exactly what to Google when I need to find something specific. I'm too good at shopping online. And so I tried to look up this birthmark thing both last night and all morning, and like specifically like end of the affair book, birthmark boy, like things like that. And I could not find anything besides about the movie.
So we're going to do our top five.
Phil, I have one question for you before we move on. Do you think that when we do our 52 in review, our year end, our pod end Oscar, our pod end re-Oscaring, do you think Julianne Moore is going to make the cut for you?
It's a really good question. My short answer is maybe. Part of it is, and we're about to do our top fives. You know. Magnolia is on my list. It will surprise nobody. I think that, and that's not a lead performance. I would say that's definitely a supporting performance. So the supporting nominees for 99 are really solid. So it's a stacked category. So it's hard for me to say whether or not Julianne Moore might slot into that for me. I don't know if she makes the top five best actress performances for me total. But maybe, I don't know. My short answer is she probably definitely makes my top 10. Not sure if she makes top five.
I would say for me,
yeah.
Before seeing this movie, I thought there was no chance.
Right.
And having seen this movie, I would say there is a chance.
Yes, I feel the same way. Yeah.
And I do keep kind of a running list, actually, but which I forgot to update recently. But yeah, I think there's a chance.
My number five, we'll just kind of go around in a circle, Carrie. My number five is Shortcuts. Not really a movie that has a lead performance, but it is got a hell of a Julianne Moore scene in it. That certainly there's like a full frontal nudity scene where she delivers this crazy monologue and she's unbelievable in it. If you haven't seen Shortcuts, I highly recommend it. It's a Criterion and it's amazing. It's very much, you can definitely see a very strong line between Shortcuts and Magnolia. But she's great in it and it's a great film and that's my number five. What's yours, Kenny?
My number five is, I have it here somewhere. Far From Heaven, a movie I've mentioned on this podcast before. Good She's call. Incredible in it. As close to like a...
She's amazing.
There are obviously a lot of movies where she is the star. She's the central character. But this is the one I like the most. There are plenty where there's two-handers or there are where there are ensembles that she is, you know, the standout in. But this is her film. It's a incredible.
Who did she lose to that year? I'm curious because she was definitely
2002.
Yeah.
Was it?
I'm looking it up because I'm genuinely curious here. We'll cut this. But Far From Heaven is 2002.
Halle Berry.
Oh, that sounds right. Yep.
It was Halle Berry. It was Nicole Kidman for The Hours.
Oh, you're right, Kenny. You're absolutely right.
Okay. I couldn't remember if, The Hours that's, was
I mean,
two or three.
That's that. Can I just say The Hours feels like another one of those, like, Nicole Kidman's done a bunch of great movies, so we're going to give it to her for The Hours?
It was, except, you know, Joe Reed would fight you to the death on that.
He would fight me to the death for it.
it was actually, you know, the Academy so often gets the best actress category totally wrong.
Yeah.
But this is a pretty good year. It's Kidman, Salma Hayek for Frida, Diane Lane for Unfaithful, Julianne Moore, and Renee Zellweger for
Chicago.
For Chicago. So yeah, it's really strong.
But I mean, we know how you feel about category fraud, Kenny. Nicole Kidman, is that category fraud? Or is she a best actor?
Well, you know, I've never seen that movie. So
really?
I think it's category fraud.
I think it's category. She's only in it for like 11 minutes. Yeah.
She's just like, I think.
She's barely in it for 11 minutes?
It's like maybe 15 minutes.
She just plays the most significant historical figure in the movie, and she wore the fake nose.
She is the catalyst, and she is the thing that narratively brings the film together. But she's not the protagonist. She's not the protagonist of the film.
That's how. Well, all right. So as you know, and I should watch this movie. But as you know, that's really what it comes down to me. It comes down to for me: are they the protagonist or not? It's that simple. And in general, it's almost impossible to be the protagonist without a majority of the screen time. The most amount of screen time.
Yeah.
But it's possible, right? You know, dual protagonist movies certainly exist. I think this is one. I think we just watched one. I think, you know, Ralph Fiennes and Julianne Moore are both protagonists of this film. So
totally.
Yes, that sounds like category fraud. I will have to do your research further.
Carrie, what's your number five?
I just changed mine after this discussion. I changed it to The End of the Affair. I did have a very weird choice. My list is pretty weird. My the one I just bumped was I'm Not There, which she is in.
Oh, wow. The Bob Dylan movie.
Mm-hmm.
I saw she was in it, but I didn't really remember where.
She plays like a Joan Baez type character.
Joan Baez.
And she's not biased, sorry. And she's like sitting I just remember the visuals so strongly, which is why I had it on. I haven't seen the movie in a long time, so couldn't tell you the specific details, but I just remember her like sitting in this patterned chair, like holding a cat. And it's just like the thing I remember the most about the movie besides Cate Blanchett as Bob Dylan.
Yeah,
sure.
So when I was going through Julianne Moore's filmography, I was like, this is the thing, one of the movies I associate her with, even though her role is so small in it, which is why I wanted to put it on, because I feel like that's my favorite thing about her. But I'm choosing The End of the Affair because it's a performance I didn't think about at all after the first time I saw it. But now I think it's going to be a performance I think about a lot and a performance I associate her with.
Yeah, it's she's fantastic in it. My number four is Children of Men. Mm-hmm. I think she's amazing in this film. I also think it's one of those performances where a character, spoiler, dies relatively early in the film. Like a lead character dies and you feel their resonance after they've left the screen. The scene that they have with the ping pong ball with that oneer inside the car is not just a technical feat in itself, but what she's doing, the chemistry she has, the history that she feels like she has with Clive Owen is so palpable. And she's fucking awesome in that movie. It's a great movie. It's a phenomenal movie. Mm-hmm. But that's my number four. What's yours, Kenny?
I thought about putting that on the list, but I couldn't, like, I've seen that movie maybe a couple times, hasn't been a long time, and I couldn't remember what she brought to it. Mm-hmm. You know, interestingly enough, I watched The Fugitive within the last 3 months. She's in it for about 5 minutes, and the movie's incredible. But the mere fact that she's in the movie means it can't get on the list. Is not the reason enough to put it on the list.
She's great in that inner two scenes, though.
I debated putting The Fugitive on mine.
Yeah, she's so good in it, but you know. So
yeah.
And there's so few people who actually have any real... Like she's like the fourth lead, because Harrison Ford, but whatever. So I didn't do that. I did... I'm going to put The Big Lebowski at four.
Wow.
I'm going to put The Big Lebowski at four instead of what I had.
Okay.
I
is this a just, swap? Is this, did you with, just flip with, four,
with,
three,
with
and four?
With what was in three, yes.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm going to put The Big Lebowski at four. She's amazing in it, obviously. I remember seeing it in the theaters after her little breakout, being like, wait, this woman can do anything. I love her in the film. I love what she brings to that film. I love that film, but I don't think when you think about that movie, you think about her performance. I think you think of the three guys. I think you think of the Jesus. I think you think of...
there's so many to think of.
Philip Seymour Hoffman. I think of Tara Reid. I think of... I think of Sam. Which Sam is it? Sam Shep? No, the other
Sam
one.
Elliott.
Sam Elliott.
I
don't really think of Julianne Moore much in that film. That being said, look, it's an amazing film. She's amazing in it. But I think there are other ones that need to be highlighted. Including the one I swapped it with.
Carrie, what's your number four?
My four is The Kids Are All Right.
Great movie. She's great in it.
She is. I rewatched it recently and we were talking earlier about how she has chemistry with everyone. She has chemistry with Annette Bening and Mark Ruffalo. Also,
incredible chemistry.
Also a good sex scene in that movie because it's very realistic sex because it's very, very awkward and very weird. And I remember the first time seeing it, watching that sex scene, I was so uncomfortable. And I was just like realizing in real time, you can actually make a sex scene that actually feels like real sex. Like it doesn't have to be movie sex. It doesn't have to be romantic, even though it is Mark Ruffalo and Julianne Moore, two of the hottest people probably working at that time and today. It still is like, I don't want to watch this. This is really weird. And I think that's a testament to their performances and her in general as a performer. So,
yeah, I love The Kids Are All Right. I rewatched it relatively recently and, yeah, that movie didn't get enough love. And by that, I mean awards love. It feels like it got a lot of another Annette Bening performance it's a great, great movie. My number three is The Big Lebowski. unlike you, Kenny, I do really associate her with this film. But I would also say, too, that I just love that apparently the Coen brothers, she showed up on set with this accent. Like they didn't tell her to do an accent. She just showed up with this accent. And it just makes, I just love this. It's the most bizarre accent. Like it's sort of British. It's kind of like Madonna doing a British accent. Like it's sort of this weird thing. I find her unbelievably funny in the Big Lebowski. And also like, surprisingly sweet. I don't know. I think she's a real standard in that film, but I adore it. But what's your number three, Kenny?
My number three is The Kid's All Right. That's what I swapped it with. Yep. Gary made all the arguments that I would have made for why. I just really love her in this film. And I love the movie. It was, to me, you know, as a young jerk, it was the first
an Edward time Furlong, a young punk.
Yeah, a young punk like Furlong. It was one of the first times I had really seen a lesbian relationship portrayed on screen as casually as you'd portray a hetero relationship. Mm-hmm. And how flawed she was. That was a real choice. Both of the characters. But that was a real choice and very bold. And I think I don't know if it was made as a PSA for why gay adoption is perfectly fine.
Totally fine. Yeah.
But I think it was done in a really kind of, if it were, I think it was done in a really astute way. It didn't lionize anybody or deify anybody. It was really just, you know, parents are parents, people are people, you know, relationships are hard.
Yeah.
And this relationship is, you know, particularly tricky, but the kids are all right. that's my three.
What's your three, Carrie?
My three is Far From Heaven. I love that movie. I have not seen it in a long time, but Kenny, all the reasons you said are why I like it. Phil, you said earlier, she's like a chameleon. She can fit in any time period, and she fits both the 40s and the 50s. So well, and she feels like completely different people in both movies. I just think it's rare that an actress can do so many different eras, and it's Far From Heaven's great. I also really like Todd Haynes. I had a big Todd Haynes phase when I was a teenager. A lot of these movies are movies that I liked when I was a teenager, so including my ones.
You bring up Todd Haynes. I think it's worth highlighting him for a second, because I do feel like he's one of those filmmakers that he struggles to get his films made, just in terms of the fact that he's really an artist and an auteur who's trying to sort of make things that aren't as cathartic perhaps as people would want them to be. They're very art PC. I mean, Far From Heaven is very much this sort of metatextual commentary on Douglas Sirk and all the various things that are existing within a filmography of a filmmaker that not a lot of people know. You know, looking at Velvet Goldmine, looking at I'm Not There. I mean, he's looking at all these different ways of sort of deconstructing artists and what they're doing and how they're doing it.
Superstar.
Exactly. I think he's thinking about his support of Kelly Reichardt. He produced Certain Women, and he's a phenomenal filmmaker and a lover of the art form. And I think that his filmography already is phenomenal, but I think we're going to look back on this filmmaker in particular and feel like we didn't know what we had when we had it.
Because of his relationship with Julianne Moore too and other actresses, I think he's one of those rare male directors who really understands how to direct women and female characters in particular.
Absolutely. My number two is Magnolia. It will surprise nobody that what my number two and one are. But, you know, there's a really great piece that Hunter Harris wrote for Vulture a few months ago about the scene in Magnolia in the pharmacy where Julianne Moore is having just a full-on fucking meltdown, and reasonably so. It's definitely the scene that she's remembered for in the film. It's awesome. It's great. It's got all this tension and also humor in it. And it weaponizes, it's just the full Julianne Moore, right? Like, it's weaponizing everything that she can bring to a scene. She's just the range and the humanity that she brings to these characters that can seem deeply unlikable, she's a tour de force. She's an unbelievable mm-hmm. actor. But yeah, Magnolia is my number two. I'm assuming, Kenny, that it might be yours.
It is. Same reason. I mean, the one thing I wanted to add was, you know, Carrie, you're talking about how she fits slots in perfectly in the 40s, perfectly in the 50s. And we didn't talk about this with the kids are all right, but I love her as a contemporary person.
Totally.
Particularly a high status one. I thought that was unexpected. She has a very earthy quality to her, right? Almost crunchy quality to her. And her in The Kids Are All Right makes perfect sense to me. Mm-hmm. But Magnolia really, to me, is a great example of just how you can take a role that might seem mundane in someone else's hands and just show layers and the inner life. And, you know, she probably only had 20, 25 minutes of screen time, but it was really, really gorgeous. So that's my number two.
Yeah. I just to very quickly piggyback on that, I'll just say that I've read a lot of interviews with Julianne Moore talking about Magnolia in particular and how it was a hard film for her to do. It was a hard role for her to do. It's a very sort of, it's a character that is putting herself through some, you know, the real ringer. I mean, she mm-hmm. you know, attempts suicide at the end of the film. And like, it's just, she has a lot to do. And you said this too, Kenny, she doesn't have a ton of screen time. Like, there's not a lot with her in the film, and what she's capable of doing in these short bursts is just, I mean, unbelievable. But what's your number two, Carrie?
My number two is Children of Men, which is,
okay,
I was going to make it my number one, but I was like, she's not a big enough character, so that wouldn't be fair. But Children of Men is one of my favorite movies of all time, and a movie that came out and I watched when I was a person who was starting to become obsessed with movies. And I knew who Julianne Moore was.
Sure.
I'd seen, I think at that time I was like starting to become like the film nerd, and I was like, I think I watched like Magnolia and sure, like all sure. these movies we're talking about. I was getting into those. And this was so different from what I'd seen of her. And I also kind of knew her as this more like glamorous movie star who's you see it on the Oscars red carpet. So mm-hmm. for me, I was so shocked when she gets, spoiler alert again, killed towards the beginning of the movie. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Because to me, I was like, oh, like she's the main character in this movie. This movie is about Julianne Moore. And like you said, like Phil said, you still feel her presence throughout the rest of the movie. And her chemistry with Clive Owen is like so electric that it's like kind of disgusting.
Another guy who struggles to have chemistry with his female leads.
These British guys. What is it?
Who'd have thunk?
Who'd have thunk?
Yeah. I mean, I think Harry Styles is making up for all.
He's doing his best.
Yeah. We'll see. But I don't know. It's. I just couldn't not put it on my list because it's one of my absolute favorite movies ever, and she just happens to be in it, and she's one of my favorite parts in it.
She's amazing. My number one's Boogie Nights. I mean, I think you know. What's there to say that hasn't been said about the film? But I'll just say that I think it's worth noting. We've talked a fair amount about sex scenes. I think it's worth noting Julianne Moore's fearlessness is the wrong word, but she does sex scenes she does them in a way that feels incredibly grounded and incredibly emotional and feels very human. And she's willing to put herself out there in that way, not to titillate people, but to say that sex is a part of life. Sex is a thing that people do. And I think that that's sadly a rarity. I feel like women, certainly in Hollywood, feel perhaps like they have to do sex scenes as though that's part of their job. And I think that Julianne Moore takes it to the next level and makes it something so much richer and more interesting. And I think she does that unbelievably in Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
A movie about the sex industry. You know, I think that a movie that I think at the time was misread by some people as being sort of this audacious sex movie. And I don't even really think it's even that much about pornography when everything is said and done. But yeah. What about you, Kenny?
Same, obviously. the best. Yeah. What can I say? In my ongoing quest to be more myself, I have to accept that Boogie Nights is like just one of my like five favorite movies, and everything about it is perfect, and she's perfect, and I love it so much. So, as much as it pains me to like put it above like. What at the end of the day is probably my favorite movie of 1999, which is Magnolia. It just is what it is. Yeah.
No,
it's my favorite movie in 97 is better than my favorite movie of 99. What are you going to do? I love it. It's the best.
I not to harp on this too much, but I just want to say that the range of what she does in Boogie Nights, we talked earlier about how she should have won the Academy Award, but just like think about the scene when she's doing a ton of cocaine with Heather Graham, or the scene when she's crying outside the courthouse. Mm-hmm. Like what she's able to do with a look, the relationship she has with Mark Wahlberg in that film, that's mother and lover and like all these things that she's baked into this role. It's amazing stuff. What's your number one, Carrie?
Boogie Nights.
I mean, just assuming. I mean, how could it not be? But yeah,
people are probably going to roll their eyes like, oh, like this girl couldn't. Well, I'm a woman. Couldn't even put Magnolia on her list. But it's honestly been such a long time since I've seen it, and I
get it.
It's not that I don't like it. It's just not my favorite PTA movie.
Neither.
Kind of upsetting to me, and yeah, it's like a kind of upsetting movie to me. Like I've wanted to rewatch it. But every time I'm about to do it, I'm just like, I can't fucking do this. So
it feels like an undertaking, but
it's less daunting for me to like watch all of the Lord of the Rings special editions in one day, you know. Sure.
You almost need to plan your day around Magnolia. Yes. You need to like, have a good breakfast. Set the room the right way, maybe light a candle or two. It should be raining outside, preferably rain. Maybe
it can't be sunny. It can't be a sunny day.
No.
The candles, the scent has to be right. You know, but it's all.
You're in the right environment right now. Like the Northeast, even though it's a SoCal movie, like it does not feel like Southern California at all.
No, it doesn't.
It feels like somewhere cold.
It feels like Seattle or like London.
Yes.
Yeah,
London. It has a real London vibe.
Yeah. It's almost like the end of The Affair. It's like very gloomy and rainy.
Yes.
Or Phantom Thread.
Weird. It never rains in California, and yet like that movie is so rain drenched.
Yeah, it's the best.
That movie's so stupid.
I haven't thought about that.
Makes no sense.
So I think, like, Phil, you kind of touched on this with Julianne Moore in Boogie Nights, but I think she's so good at kind of controlling her sexuality in this movie and in a lot of her other roles, including the end of The Affair. Like, all these movies, she has such a command of herself and her characters. And we're talking about all these movies, and she just has, she's so good at capturing these people with very complicated relationships with people. It's because she's so charming and her chemistry, she has chemistry with everyone because she's such a magnetic person, and she can just give you in just a scene or just in a moment like history with a character that you've only known for a few minutes or a few seconds. It's just, I can't think of anyone else who really has this unique gift.
No, I absolutely agree. And I think it's also just worth saying too that, you know, I've watched her in, you know, interviews on late night shows and what have you. And she just seems so affable as well. I mean, I don't know her as a person, obviously. And we all know that, you know, she's an actor. I mean, maybe she's just acting that way on these shows, but she just seems like a real person. I mean, I follow her on Instagram and what have you. And she just seems like a genuine person. She seems to, you know, and I think that's part of it too. I don't get a lot of bullshit from her. I mean, even when she's in movies that I might not necessarily like, I always find her really compelling. And even like I watched a Don John relatively recently because they did an episode of Blank Check, and I'll watch this. She's good in it. That movie's bonkers, but like she's very good in it, and she's bringing a very real, lived-in person to a film that doesn't have many of them. So.
Yeah, or even isn't she's like the president in the Hunger Games?
I believe that's true. I believe that's true.
And even that, and that's such a that's a really weird role for her, but because it's like so it's the opposite of what you think of her doing. It's this very harsh and kind of horrible person.
So the Hunger Games was a Magnolia reunion, but and Boogie Nights reunion for Phil Seymour Hoffman and her. Interesting.
Oh yeah. Oh my god, I forgot. Oh my god.
He's like Blue Dark,
like,
whatever.
Last fucking movie.
Yeah,
my god.
It's really sad.
I mean, both of them are really good in the, I think they're in the last two movies, which are like, I don't really remember them. They're like,
I don't remember.
Okay. You don't have to. But their scenes are so good together. She's good, but she just has this, I hate to say fire in her because she's a redhead and that's like, you know, I don't know if that's offensive, but.
Just a little too easy. Come on.
Yeah, it's too easy. She's just like, I don't know. Like, I feel like a boomer would say she's a firecracker. And that would be.
A boomer would definitely say that.
Real firecracker, Julianne Moore.
Yeah, and a testament to the boomer who would say that. Like, that's correct.
Yes. they're the generation that created capitalism for a reason, you know?
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. Yeah. Carrie, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us. It's always a pleasure. We hope that you'll come back for something else in the future.
Oh,
there's other things and things we've seen, things we haven't seen, and television to talk about and all that. But as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
And you'll get to see another angle of my apartment.
Can't wait.
Can't wait to it.
New angle every time. Thank you, guys. All right, guys.
Bye. One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.